Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 235 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm doing okay considering everything. It's good to be with you.
We will do this really quick. Can you do the introduction on Ashley real quick?
Well, sure, but I'm going to have to monologue for a little bit because my computer is not opening the document or I'm just going to read from.
I can take care of it for you if you'd like.
Oh, well, then you go right ahead.
Where did it go? Let's see. Let me find it. Oh, Ashley. Good grief. Where did you put it in here, man?
I got it here. Okay. Tonight, we have a special guest who's been with us from time to time. Ashley Raymore Cloud is a former district attorney, assistant district attorney with the 13th Judicial District Attorney's Office. And also, she was with the 2nd Judicial District Attorney's Office. I left that out. She departed the DA's office in 2019 to join the defense bar and handles a variety of cases, including PFR-type cases. She spent the better part of her 25-year legal career as a prosecutor in New Mexico. As a prosecutor, she also held positions as the felony DWI supervisor, arson division supervisor, and supervisor of the DA clinical law program. During her time as a prosecutor, Ashley has prosecuted and tried numerous cases, including child sex crimes, murder, property crimes, drug crimes, domestic violence, escape from jail, arson, DWIs, it goes on and on. Ashley has also practiced in domestic relations, white collar, bankruptcy, and now she's on the criminal defense side, the right side of this. And she was recently recognized by the law offices of the public defender as the contract attorney of the year. So welcome back, Ashley.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be back. It's always good to be with you people.
He has you trained with the you people part. The mm-hmm. reason why I wanted to do the introduction just out of the script was because we have a little bit of a memorial that we want to express, and Ashley's going to do that part. And I didn't want to have some random voice show up out of nowhere to describe what has occurred in the last handful of days. So, Ashley, will you go ahead?
So, sadly, we lost one of our own. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago, I believe.
Yeah, it was Grant.
Yep. He left us on Tuesday. We are very, very distraught over this. Larry and I both worked with him for numerous years. Larry has worked with him for quite a bit of time, and it's been very hard. So I just wanted to take recognition and say that we will miss him.
That's really sad. I'm really tragic and unexpected, obviously. I mean, he was young, early 20s, yes?
Yes, he was in his early 20s. It was very unexpected and very sudden. And it's just, there's no words for this kind of loss. Our hearts go out to his family and everyone else as well.
Absolutely. I'm sorry to hear that. Larry, I'm sorry for the loss as well.
Thank you.
Well, so I hope you are ready to go forward instead of, are you going to be okay for the episode, Larry?
I'll do my best.
Okay. So what do we have going on this episode?
Oh, we have a lot of stuff. We have a case from the Kansas Supreme Court, which is fascinating to say the least. A person was convicted of failure to comply while he was locked in a psychiatric hospital. And we have a question from a supporter named Joel in Colorado. And we plan to touch on the sentencing of the individual involved in January 6th that got the 7-year sentence, if we have time. And I think you even had some observations and questions on that particular case.
I think I do. Well, let's see here. Do you have any current things that you want to mention? Wasn't it Jobs Friday yesterday?
Yes, it was. There was an awesome jobs report released yesterday, 528,000 new jobs added, and an all-time record number of people working in America. I won't say they're all Americans, but that's what the people generally say. But we have an all-time high number of people working. We have wage gains across the economic spectrum. We have approaching 11 million jobs still open, remaining to be filled. I think that number dropped to something between 10 and 10.5 million. So despite all the gloom and doom from the naysayers, the economy remains very strong. So that's the positive news for the week.
So I recall back in the whatever 08-09 time frame when like the economy was going into free fall, like it was 800,000 jobs being lost per month. So 500 to be gained, I imagine, is an incredibly strong number.
You are recalling correctly during the 08 debacle when the economy was collapsing, we were losing 500,000 and 600,000 plus jobs per month, and we ended up being in a very deep recession.
All right, so we had an awesome, awesome jobs report, and we will move on just to, I guess you're just doing that to try and balance from all the negative news that goes out about the crappy economy. But the Fed raised the interest rate a couple weeks ago, too, another 3/4%. All right, then I think we can continue. I'll try to continue. Let's go over to this question that we had from Joel in Colorado. And we already did the introduction with Ashley. And so welcome back, Ashley. Really, I didn't get a chance to say that. But thank you very much for coming on. It's always fun to have you on. You're a great banterer.
It's great to be on. And I enjoy the banter on this as well.
Tell me about your recent award as a contract attorney. Is this like a hired hitman kind of person?
Sometimes it feels like that, actually. So in the past, every year they have a public defender conference. And in the past, they would give a public defender the attorney of the year. And this is the first year they actually decided to give a similar award to contract attorneys. And out of 250 attorneys, I was chosen as the contract attorney of the year across the state.
Out of how many people?
250.
So just one or two?
just one or two.
I mean, if there were like five attorneys, then I'd be like, okay, so they just sort of gave you a token appreciation, but out of a couple hundred, that means something to me.
There was somebody, in all fairness, there was somebody else who was also named down south. I don't know who that person is, but it was still quite an honor.
Would you mind taking a few minutes and talk about what your daily kind of run sheet is, your calendar looks like from is there such a thing as a typical day?
No, nothing in my day is typical, but as Larry can speak to, sometimes he looks at my calendar and then he will text me and say, your calendar is sick.
Oh, and that's not the bad sick, is it?
It could be either way. It's pretty laughable. There are times when you look at my calendar and I'm supposed to be in 7 different courts all at the same time. So it can be quite the juggle, spend a lot of time in court. So with it being virtual because of the pandemic, some of it is manageable, but a lot of the courts have gone to a hybrid system where you have to be in person and also virtual, and it's causing some interesting logistics. Luckily, I'm pretty good friends with a couple of other attorneys that are also contract attorneys, and so we've started to tag team in to each other's hearings or cover stuff if one person is in a courtroom. But then there's days when I'm sitting here and I've got my phone up in one courtroom, I've got two laptops running in the other courtrooms, and I'm juggling judges, hoping nobody calls on me.
Yikes. All right, then. Can you think of anything in the recent past that you're particularly proud of?
I've had a couple of good outcomes at trial lately. During the pandemic, I've done 3 trials. I did a rape, a homicide, and then most recently in May, I did a shooting at a occupied dwelling, which here in New Mexico is considered a second degree felony, meaning it's punishable by up to 9 years. Plus there were a bunch of other charges. So my client was facing about 25, 30 years. I had a plea offer for him that he would have gotten out in another 3 months, and he did not want to take the plea. And I didn't think we had a defense on that case. And the previous attorney said, there is no way, don't take that case to trial. You're going to lose. But my client wanted to go to trial. I never make him plead. And we went to trial, and it just kept getting better and better and better. And the jury was out about an hour and came back with not guilty on everything, including an aggravated fleeing charge, which happened in front of officers, meaning he'd ran from officers, meaning they didn't believe anybody. And there were some really interesting things that happened during that trial, including the prosecutors tried to get the fingerprint person. They were trying to tie my client to the scene, and they were trying to get a fingerprint person to say that was the box of ammunition that had the bullets that were fired, had my client's fingerprint on it. But they didn't lay the foundation right. And so the fingerprint person went, I've never seen that box before in my life. Now, the judge knew why, I knew why, prosecutors knew why, but in the jury's mind, they believed there was some big screw up and it never got corrected. So I just hammered that in closing along with several other things. And it was a lot of fun.
All right. Do we have a case in here that you want to talk about from the Kansas Supreme Court?
Are you talking to me? Yes, we have Kansas Supreme Court and we have the question from Joel.
Okay. Oh, I haven't done the question from Joel yet. Oh, let's do the, sorry. The question from Joel. It says, to whom it may concern. I am a subscriber to the Narsaw Digest, and I saw your advertisement regarding your podcast. That's not accurate. Registry matters, and I would like to obtain a sample transcript of a recent podcast or a podcast that relates to my situation of being released from prison in the next 60 days to Colorado. I have to register as soon as I am released and am under federal SORNA requirements. However, prior to my incarceration, I registered in the city of Aurora, Colorado, in which I had to self-report to FCI Inglewood 2 months later. A few days after my self-reporting to incarceration to serve a 48-month sentence, the City of Aurora Police Department made a visit to my wife at my residence, informing her that my charge of access with internet to view was not a registerable crime in the state and that the state does not recognize my only charge, access with intent to view. So I'm in limbo as to when I'm released and when I register, and the state still does not recognize my crime as a registerable offense. Yet, by federal law, I must register. Who takes precedent? Anyway, I'm looking forward to listening to your podcast upon release. I may be able to participate in your discussions regarding the topics, as I'm an advocate for major reform regarding PFR laws and the registry. Thank you for your time, and looking forward to your transcript. Please mail the transcript to blah, 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 blah.
So this person, he wrote this and I got the opportunity to work on it because I know an attorney who's in the Denver metro area who does work related to this issue. So I called the attorney and we had a discussion about the case. I shared the letter and she knows the detective over at Aurora PD that handles PFR registrations. So they don't have any records in their files that reflect what he says in this letter in terms of this not being a registrable offense. And in fact, they registered him. He was registered for the time he was waiting for his voluntary surrender, which actually stumped the attorney because she was saying, well, wait a minute, he must have another charge. I said, no, he did his plea and he was given voluntary surrender. And I said, when the judge entered the conviction and sentence, and allowed him to self-surrender, I said it was a period of time where he would needed to have registered. And so they accepted his registration. And I'm not saying that they didn't go by and visit with the family because they may have been doing a standard residency check, but they did not, according to the detective's recollection, tell him that, the family that, and they also, they took his registration. And he was complying for that period of time he was waiting for his surrender date. The attorney said that this would translate to a Colorado offense in her professional opinion, but she'd be more than delighted to have a conversation with Joel if he so chooses. But this looks like something that would trigger a duty under Colorado law to register. Now, in terms of the federal, what controls, that's still up for debate. I maintain that a state gets to choose to register whomever it wants to register, and it gets to decline registering people it doesn't want to register. And that's part of our system in the United States, that we recognize federalism and they don't have to register. Colorado doesn't have to register anybody to begin with. And they certainly don't have to register people that they don't think have an offense that's covered by the scope of their registration law. But there's circuit law that says to the contrary, that there's an independent federal duty, particularly the Willman case out of Michigan, I believe it was. But that is not a national precedent. That's within that one circuit. And the 10th Circuit doesn't have any such precedent, which is where Colorado is in the 10th Circuit. So Ashley, do you have anything to add to it? But I think the guy's going to have to register. And particularly, I think, for the period of his supervision, he doesn't want to fight this battle while he's under supervision.
So I agree he doesn't want to fight this battle while he's under supervision. The only other thing I would possibly add is if, in fact, It is not a translatable offense, and he doesn't have to register. He needs to really get good documentation on that in case his federal supervised probation people come looking for him and asking him about his compliance with it. So if it does go down that path, I would just advise having really good documentation, not just saying, oh, so-and-so told me I didn't have to register. And that's my only additional 2 cents.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about there, Larry?
No, I think that covered it. I hope that it's helpful to him. And for the relevancy, it's for anybody who may be in a similar situation. If you have something you don't think translates to a registrable offense, I would strongly encourage you, if it was dictated to you that you will register by the court, at least for the period that the court has jurisdiction over you, in terms of possibly taking your freedom away, you probably would want to register if the state will accept your registration. Now, if you go into to the registration office and they say, sorry, we don't register obscene phone calls here, too bad, so sad, then you really can't register. So if you transferred from Georgia to Colorado and they don't have a provision that registers that offense, it's not an equivalent offense in Colorado, then you did the best you could. Would Georgia revoke you if you didn't register in Colorado? Ashley, what do you think? Would the prosecutor Cherokee County, Georgia, be upset that the person was able to dodge registration by getting here and being told that they didn't have to register?
If it was a condition of their probation, I think Georgia would take somebody back in a heartbeat. But what do I know about that, Larry?
Well, so
is that similar to the person we talked about? I think it was North Carolina that wanted to, like, he went in 3 times to say, hey, look, should I register? And then they were like, hey, you're supposed to be registered. And he got jammed in the tuchus.
That is similar. Some people just can't take no for an answer.
And your legal opinion, but not lawyer level opinion, is if you are not, how do I want to word this? If you move to a place that you've been off the registry and, like, don't go tell them that you're there because you don't have a duty to tell them that you're there, something like that.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far on a program with tens of thousands of people listening and probably some law enforcement, but I would say a little more cautiously that if you have been dutifully discharged from registration with documentation, not that you're choosing just not to present yourself, but if you've been dutifully discharged, it would be very unlikely, in my opinion, that they would secure a conviction, because it's plausible that a reasonable person receiving a letter saying, or an order, whichever it is, in some cases it's a court order, but receiving an order or a letter saying you have no duty to register, a reasonable person could go to a state and not believe they have to register. Now, Ashley was in prosecution for 25 years. If a case like this came in the 13th Judicial District that a person had been released from registration in Georgia and they moved here and Regina said that they should register, would you take that as a prosecution when you were screening cases?
Absolutely not. I would take it that they attempted to comply, that they were in substantial compliance, and I wouldn't prosecute it. There's no intent there. But I think that ties us into that Kansas case about intent.
So, well, yeah, but if a person has been released from registration through an official mechanism, be it where they time out and they just simply are told that your period has ended, which is the way we do it here, of those who have the privilege of timing out if they're in the 10 or 20 year group. But, or if you've been petitioned and been successful and you've got an order, I can't see a prosecutor in most jurisdictions wanting to take that case because it's reasonable. There's a reasonable doubt that you thought you had to register. So I just don't see that anything's possible, but I see that they're going to give you a notice to register and say, we believe you're covered. And then you can fight it out in court if you don't believe you're covered in that state.
Well, let's move over to the case from Kansas that you people put in here versus Daniel or Earl Jensen. And I've read it and I think that the guy got screwed, and I'm hoping that you can finally admit someone got screwed. Larry, can you finally... can we all say, like, good evening, Larry? Hi, Larry. Can you admit that this guy got screwed?
Yes.
Okay. Well, cool. Then we're probably done with the podcast right now. All right. Well, I guess we'll cover some bases. After his conviction for attempted voluntary manslaughter, Jensen needed to register as a violent offender under Kansas Offender Registration Act. Is that the same Offender Registration Act as PFRs?
Yes, it's called CORA, K-O-R-A.
Yeah, but I'm saying like he did something related to murder, not a sexual offense, and they have
yes.
it classified in the same place. That's interesting.
Yes, same registry.
Okay, and then so on August 29th, 2017, he did so at the Riley County Police Department. The forms Jensen completed informed him that he had to register every May, August, November, and February, and upon certain occasions, such as when his address changed. On September 18th, Jensen came in to report a change of phone number. He came in again on October 9th to report an address change, but Jensen failed to show up for his registration appointment. In November, he registered on December 15th, which was 15 days late. So what happened next there, Larry?
Well, the state charged him with violation of CORA. And this is a severity level 6 felony based on his failure to report in person during the month of November 2017. And before trial, the party stipulated that Jensen had been convicted of a non-sexual crime, still requiring registration under CORA. And Jensen filed notice of intent to assert a defense of mental disease or defect.
All right. Well, Ashley, if you can explain the notice he filed, I noticed that the state objected because Kansas eliminated a mens rea element for CORA violation, making it strict liability offense, which is what is a mens rea and why is that important to the case?
Sorry, I had to get back to my mute button.
Okay.
So mens rea is extremely important. In all cases, it is the essence of the case. And what mens rea actually means is your mental intent or your mental capability, depending on whether it's a strict liability, a specific intent, or a general intent crime. The thing with mens rea is you have to, in order to convict somebody of a crime, you have to have both mens rea and the actual action of the crime, and it's always in the elements. Now there's nuances again as to whether you had to intend, for example, you had to intend to shoot somebody or you had to intend to cross the street across the light. But all those are mens rea. You still have to mentally commit a crime. And when I say mentally commit a crime, I don't mean you're just thinking about it. You have to actually have some mental culpability for it. Now, that's diminished if you have an insanity or diminished capacity claim. In some jurisdictions, you don't have full insanity defenses. At best, you can argue diminished capacity. But what that means is that you couldn't form that mental intent. You lacked the mental intent to commit a crime. And that's where this went completely south in this case.
So it seems that Jensen argued, among other things, that the state's construction would allow for the conviction of an individual who falls into a coma during his month of registration and is physically and mentally incapable of complying. Jensen did not clearly articulate an argument that his mental illness rendered him physically incapable of complying with his registration obligations, nor did Jensen's reply raise a constitutional claim, although he would later develop the same argument in challenging the statute's constitutionality. The district court rejected Jensen's request for his mental disease or defect defense, agreeing with the state that mens rea is not an element of the crime charged. Accordingly, it held Jensen's mental health in November of 2017 was irrelevant. This can't be right. He was in a psychiatric hospital. How do you register if you're in a hospital, Larry? What happened next?
Well, the case proceeded to trial, and Jensen's attorney noted that he had been involuntarily committed at Osawatomie State Hospital for roughly the first half of December 2017 and challenged the constitutionality of strict liability registration violation offenses. And Jensen's attorney also asserted that he had a constitutional right to present his mental health defense, that he did not believe that the strict liability statute of CORA is constitutional, period, and that there was a constitutional argument as to statute as to why the mental health issue should be able to be discussed before the jury. That's what he said, what he argued.
Ashley, what do you have to say to what Larry just articulated?
Well, the issue with that, I mean, that's a great start to the defense, but the problem was he didn't actually state how his client's mental capacity or incapacity in this instance prevented him from registering. So he never actually applied his client's facts to what he was arguing. And that's a big issue. Whenever you're going to do something on appeal or you're going to argue anything, you have to say, okay, here's my argument. And this is how this matters in this case. And he didn't quite get there. Right, Larry?
It didn't appear so from what I read, no.
So he could have, I mean, are you being critical of another attorney there, Ashley?
No, I would never do that. Okay. I might have done a little bit differently, but I also think that as attorneys, we sometimes get caught up in believing that because we know what our argument is, that the court automatically knows what's going on in our head. And there might have been a little bit of that going on.
Okay. The district court did not rule on the statute's constitutionality, but repeated the substance of its previous written ruling that generally questions, inquiries, evidence, or for that matter, argument related to defense of mental defect are not going to be allowed. As the district court put it, a ruling on the statute's constitutionality will be the appellate court's function. In its eventual journal entry of jury trial, the district court characterized this as a ruling of the state's motion in, come on, limine? What is that word?
Limine. Motions in limine.
What in the frickety frack? I've never heard this word before. I really had to hand props to Larry for saying the Asatawa Tommy word, and now we're at this limine?
Motions in limine are what make trials go smoother. Both sides tend to file motions in limine stating, this is not allowed or this is allowed. And then they make the argument before the judge before the trial proceeds so that you don't have to keep going up there and interrupting the flow of the testimony with the jury. And both sides know what kind of evidence they can get into. So, for example, I'll file motions in limine all the time on hearsay and suppression, things that I don't want them to be able to bring up, my client's past, things like that. Those are all considered motions in limine. So in this instance, what that lawyer was arguing was in his motion in limine that he was going to present this defense, but the judge shot him down.
At the end of the state's case, Jensen's counsel made these proffers of what testimony would have been if this court had allowed us to go into mental health issues. The highlights of what he proffered. The court and the state of Kansas had involuntarily committed Mr. Jensen to Osawatomie after Jensen actually took himself to a hospital. Jensen would have testified that he had not been on his medication in the month of November, that he became cognizant enough to reach out to his mother and ask for transportation to go to the hospital because he knew he needed help. He was unable to reach his mother, and Mr. Jensen was able to get himself to the hospital. He would testify he believed that he would be out by the end of November, beginning of December. He spent his time at Osawatomie up through December 14th. And when he was out of Osawatomie, God, could you not write these things so many times? After he was out of that place and medicated on his proper treatment plan, he registered the following day. Come on, man. Why can't they have some level of compassion that the guy was in the hospital not taking his medicine?
Well, despite all this, the court found him guilty. Ashley, what happened next?
So before sentencing, Jensen moved to dismiss the case, asserting that Cora was unconstitutional under the due process clause as it applied to a strict liability standard to a crime of inaction. Jensen also filed a renewal of motion for judgment of acquittal, a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, also known as a JNOV, and a motion for a new trial in which he argued a number of things.
So, Andy, I think it's your turn.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, all right.
I got it. So he was barred from presenting any theory of defense in this case, specifically ruling that evidence concerning his mental state during the month of November 17th was ruled inadmissible and irrelevant. He proffered evidence that would have established that his mental condition during the month of November 2017 was unstable at best, and he turned himself into authorities on December 2nd, 2017. Law enforcement officers were so concerned with his mental condition that he was nearly immediately transported to that mental health hospital that I don't want to keep saying because it's complicated, while the Riley County Attorney's Office filed a care and treatment case. And the court's ruling effectively deprived him of unquestioned constitutional right to testify in his own defense in any meaningful way. Ashley, let's dig into these key points, especially about his not being able to testify. Explain how that would impact him.
So this is huge. This is absolutely huge. Jensen's lawyer put it very succinctly. Without being able to testify about what was taking place in his life during November 2017 or the reason that he turned himself into authorities on December 2nd, 2017, or his subsequent admission to that hospital, I won't even say the name of it either. I'm not even going to attempt it. Or even his initial registration address in December 2017, Mr. Jensen's potential trial testimony was essentially limited to stating his name on the record and immediately stepping down to return to the defense table to be convicted. I mean, that's basically what happened. They deprived him of pretty much his ability to defend himself.
But in this whole situation of him being in a mental hospital, wouldn't that I was in a mental hospital. Don't convict me. And the jury would then go, oh, we shouldn't convict you because you were actually incapable of going to register. I don't see how that even works at all.
I don't either. And I will say, even though it may have come across that I was a little bit critical of his lawyer on the other aspects, this was exactly the plan of attack his lawyer needed to go down. But it just, the court wasn't buying it. And essentially they deprived him of his right to defend himself.
Do you think they didn't believe the whole situation that he was in? I mean, did he get a doctor's note? Can he prove that he was in the hospital? Is there any question about that side? Or they're just flipping him the bird saying, sorry, too bad, so sad, you didn't meet your registration date?
Well, they issued the order to commit him. They know he was there. Ashley used to issue those orders or request those orders when she worked for the DA's office.
I don't understand. The Kansas Supreme Court noted, before the district court, Jensen did not clearly delineate his substantive due process arguments as arising either under the federal or Kansas Constitution. Instead, Jensen mainly framed his arguments around his constitutional right to present a defense without specifically referencing either the Kansas or federal Constitution. Why is that significant? That's to you, Ashley.
So when you go into trial at any given point, you always look as to what your appealable issues are going to be. And any good trial attorney will start from day one, writing them down. I actually sit there in a notebook. And as we go through trial, any objection that I make, any argument that I make, I write it down, whether it was overruled or sustained, everything to set that appellate record. Because if you don't basically protect those appellate rights at the trial level, the court has the discretion not to hear them at all. And that's pretty much what they did in this. They said it wasn't preserved at the trial level, and so they don't have to consider it.
That is so weird. So the trial attorney blew it, Ashley?
I can't go that far on another attorney, but here's what I would say. As an attorney, you need to be very cognizant. Now, sometimes as stuff is going down and you're focused on this issue or that issue, it's understandable that he wouldn't have preserved some of that. But if there was going to be a due process argument and a constitutional argument, he needed to lay the foundation and give the court a chance to give a ruling on it so that he could appeal it later.
And they chose to invoke the prudential exception. What is that?
Well, it was in the decision the first time I've ever seen that, but apparently it's a doctrine in Kansas that they will not consider any issues that are raised on appeal for the first time, which is very common throughout the country. But apparently they have a special rule that I've not heard of that was referenced here, the prudential exception.
All right. And then the court noted that Jensen's proffer does not establish the severity, nature, or genesis of his mental illness. Although we can loosely infer that Jensen believes the evidence would show he was not cognizant during some of November 2017. Nevertheless, Jensen's failure to register at any time during the month of November only became criminal at midnight on December 1st, 2017. They are implying that he should have registered prior to being hospitalized. And Ashley, what would your reaction to that be?
He may not have had the mental capability to register at that point. I mean, there was a lot going on and he didn't get to testify about any of it.
It's like if you are about to, if you're in the car getting into an accident and you're going to have almost a limb chopped off. Oh, crap. I forgot. I have to go register. Hold on. Let me stop the car crash. Let me go register and then go continue the car crash. Like, that doesn't even seem at all remotely logical or rational to me.
No, I completely agree. I don't know how they even got to that point, given that he couldn't explain it, he wasn't allowed to explain it. And then also, just like you just said, Andy, it's like somebody who ties their helmet to the side of their motorcycle and then says, oh, I'm about to get in an accident. Wait, let me stop and put this on. That's literally what they're asking somebody to do, is to predict the future and then act accordingly.
Jensen's claim that Cora's imposition of strict criminal liability violates his substantive due process rights rests on the interpretation of various comments set forth in numerous cases decided by the United States Supreme Court and this court across the decades. But the Supreme Court has never declared that the legislative criminalization of conduct on strict liability basis violates substantive due process. Have they?
Is that for me?
Well, I would post that to either, but I think Ashley would be, you know, she's the guest, so we'll give her the limelight.
So, according to the Kansas Supreme Court, they did not. And I think Larry would actually take issue with that, right, Larry?
I do take issue, but go ahead.
Well, I don't see how they even got there. They didn't examine several things. They declined to look at other things. And then here we are with this verdict that basically says, oh, we've never said that strict liability violates due process. And I'm not so sure that's right across the U.S., but I defer to Larry, who's really, really up on things like that.
Well, this has been an issue important to me for a long time. And I can't read into these decisions what they read into them. And they cited the correct decisions, you know, the Morissetti case from back in whatever year it was in the 50s. And they cited Excitement Video and Staples. And all these cases say just the opposite. They say that there is a presumption in our statutory scheme in favor of scienter, which is knowledge, the mens rea, and that these things should be in the statutes or presumed to exist, even though they're not in the statute, unless it's a minor regulatory infraction that doesn't carry significant consequences. I would say a level 6 felony, which is probably the lowest level in Kansas, is significant enough that you can lose your freedom. And I think that there would be the presumption that you should, there should be some culpable mental state. So I just don't agree with this decision at all. In fact, I'm going to reach out to the attorney and see if they are planning a cert petition or maybe a reconsideration, which will do no good with that bunch at that Kansas Supreme Court. But it might be worthwhile to take this to the U.S. Supreme Court on cert.
Larry, let me ask you this question, and I never ever want to like poke at you that you're not an attorney. So how do you present yourself as being like the expert in this field without having the initials and the Esquire and the cop? Like, how do you say, hi, Mr. Attorney, I see that you have all the credentials and the big high billing rate, but I know my shit. How do you present that to them so that they would take your advice and counsel?
Well, Ashley could probably answer that better than I can. Well, why do people listen to me in New Mexico?
Because Larry knows best. There is nothing else to say about it. Larry knows more about registration matters, these laws. He actually takes the time to read the opinions and not just do scans of them, and actually understands the rationale behind it. And he spent a lot of years getting to that point. So I would take his advice on pretty much anything. In fact, I do sometimes, right, Larry?
That's correct. And I think my track record from the Defense Association, Lawyers Association, I've done presentations, not recently since Kathy retired, but I think still presumed to be the go-to person. I still get inquiries on a regular basis from practicing attorneys. So I think there's still a fair amount of confidence in what I know. How I got that was from what Ashley said, was a lot of work, a lot of offering my services for free, popping on the defense lawyers listserv and answering their questions and offering to talk to them and sending them citations to what I'm saying so that they could read it for themselves. And it was just years and years of hard work.
Got it. All right. Anything else here? We have a handful more things to cover. And by my clock, we're somewhere a little over 40 minutes and we have a good little chunk left to do.
All right, let's get out of this. This was a sad case and I'm hoping that something can be done. I'll have to wait till I hear back from his legal team.
Groovy.
Is there a possibility of writing an amicus brief, Larry, on this?
if they're going to do a cert petition, that's what we would intend on doing, is we would jump in early rather than waiting. Most organizations won't do a cert petition because the grant rate of petitions is so low and you're expending resources probably for no good. But something as important as this, I think it might be somewhat persuasive to get to that magic four at the Supreme Court saying, hey, this is of great public importance. You need to define once and for all what the boundaries are in terms of when legislatures can eliminate mens rea.
I 100% agree, because I think that this could affect a lot of people on a lot of levels. And I do think that this is worthy of impact litigation or at least an appeal.
And we've even got potential conservative support on this. The Rio Grande Foundation here in New Mexico, they have spoken consistently about the danger of lack of a culpable mental state. Now, it was not because of this. It was because of UNSR getting off of, there was a blizzard on Forest Service land and he got off trail and he got a small citation. And out of principle, he appealed that and challenged the constitutionality. And the Rio Grande Foundation says you should have this in the statutory schemes. So we might even have some support from them or another organization similar to the Rio Grande Foundation.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, well, I'm going to trip you both up with a question that I just got off of YouTube like an hour before we recorded. And so this one is, could you clarify setting precedents a little bit more? Because I think last week we covered a case, Larry, that they wouldn't do anything unless there was precedent. But how do you have precedent if no case prior to has there's no precedent to set the standard? So it sounds like you have to win a case to set precedents, but how do you do that if you can't have your case heard because of no precedents? That sounds like a whole, like the picture where the snake's eating its tail and it's just stuck in a circle eating itself.
So, well, that's a great question, Andy, in terms of precedent. Since you have a right to an appeal and when you take it up to the appellate court, of course, they're looking for some citations and authority, but you would convey to them in your brief that there is nothing in existence and this is a matter of first impression. And Ashley could probably better expand on that, but you would tell them that this is a matter of first impression, but we need this guidance because this is capable of continuous repetition. And so that would be one of the arguments you would make, asking an appellate level court to be sympathetic to this. And they may still deny you, and that becomes a precedent from a court of appeals if they say, no dice, we're not interested. But that's one of the ways I would argue. Go ahead, Ashley.
So it's real interesting that you say that, because from a lawyer's perspective, nothing is worse than trying to find case law that doesn't exist on an issue that you need to bring before a judge. And so Larry's absolutely right. You do it under a first impression, or sometimes they'll call it a de novo issue, which is they just haven't heard it before, or a matter of it's the first time they've heard it. But what you see a lot of times in cases is that the court will decline to address that issue because they don't want to be the ones to set precedent. So it is a very tricky thing to do. But there are, in this case, I think there's enough precedent, actually, in the Kansas case, as an example, there's enough precedent to where other precedents can be set. Now, one last thing I want to say about precedent is it's not always good. It can be bad, too. We have in New Mexico, we have a lot of magistrate judges that are not attorneys around the state. And there is very bad decisions that come out of those. And that's what gets appealed. And they set very bad precedent sometime. So it's not always a good thing to have precedent.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering that, both of you. I told the person that it was perfectly timed that we were having an actual real life attorney joining us so that we could get that extra insight on an answer. And then there was this thing you put in there about an announcement from Georgia. Is that where we can go now, Larry?
Yeah, you can just read that quick announcement.
Sure. I can officially state that we have prevailed in the case. At a hearing this morning, the sheriff, after filing a motion to dismiss the case, represented to the court that he would no longer attempt to place signs in front of registrants' home without their permission. He has submitted a written policy stating the same. Following that representation, the judge confirmed that Reggie Holden's case would be granted summary judgment in his favor per the mandate of the 11th Circuit. On the other side, had tried to claim the changed policy mooted the 11th Circuit mandate. I assume that came from a particular attorney in Georgia?
It did indeed, and it was a Narsal case against the Butts County Sheriff. There was a simultaneous filing against the Spalding County Sheriff, which is the county adjoining Butts, and Spalding settled, and Butts wanted to have their day in court. They had their day in court, and they lost at the 11th Circuit. And I'm told that that was probably the most conservative three-judge panel that you could have put together. Sure. So they ended up losing the case that he said, I'll take all the way to Supreme Court. Well, he didn't take it all the way to Supreme Court, and now they're going to pay out a bunch of fat legal fees.
I searched everywhere I could find to try and see if that was actually recorded anywhere. I could never find a recording of him saying that. God, I wanted to find that recording. So, that would be great to just always have, I'll take that all the way to the Supreme Court. Okay, man. Rock yourself out there. Okay, so, and then that's, can I say the attorney's name?
You may.
Mark Juracek is the attorney that did that. And I think that has worked out pretty well for us, I think.
It has been a splendid success. We got criticism, and there's a particular individual in Clayton County, which is a suburban Atlanta county, that said we were crazy because we're going to create problems because his county of Clayton had never done such a thing. And he says, well, all they're going to do is pass a law where they'll have the authority to do it, because that was one of our arguments. Well, see, now they can't pass the law because the 11th Circuit has issued precedent that is good for three states in the circuit, Georgia, Florida, and Alabama, that they can't put these signs up. So despite his uninformed opinion and his criticism, now we have accomplished something in those three states, and we have something that can be argued as persuasive authority all across the country from a very conservative court. They still got it right.
Hey, and somebody in chat, this was a perfect segue. Is this like Alex Jones money payout? Like there was a $46 judgment against him? Is it that kind of money?
No, it's over six figures probably, but it won't be that kind of money. It won't be billions.
That is just ridiculous. I think he's a terrible human being for saying the things that he said, but that is a gargantuan amount of money.
So maybe he'll learn his lesson.
Maybe it will get him to not be represented. Like I say on the air, but he never was on the air, but he's just over on all of the different platforms. And but he's anyway. And then we received a really quick kind of tongue-in-cheek kind of comment from Will off of patreon.com/registrymatters. He says, I was once a friend with a DJ who taught at a broadcasting school. She told me that her pet peeve was training Southerners to say Washington as opposed to Washington. It's a Southern thing, Will said. We should have gotten him to like read that because he has a really thick Southern accent.
All righty.
Can we go into who's that speaker then?
Yes, we can do that if that's your pleasure.
It is. Well, I want to make sure that we keep this under time because we are short-staffed at FYP. And are you actively looking for a replacement to do the transcripts?
We will be in need of that person because I can't handle that additional duty indefinitely.
I don't know what else you do all day. Anywho.
There's a lot of bonbons to eat.
Ashley, maybe you can do the transcript.
No, I'm busy eating bonbons too.
Oh, okay, bonbons. Pop gummy bears?
Like I said, they can put it in anything.
All right, well, last week I played this one.
I had so much bravado. I thought I was untouchable. Made a lot of money, you know, had the big house, the fancy cars, the beautiful children, the beautiful family. When Amy came into the picture, I was full of piss and vinegar.
Any idea, Larry?
I'm stumped.
Ashley, do you want to take a stab?
I'm stumped too.
All right. So there was a sex scandal. I guess it was probably in the 90s, maybe in the late 80s. And like if you could, the picture on YouTube this week is the person. It's Joey Buttafuoco. And there was this whole thing with an underage. But anyway, that's who that was. That was Joey Buttafuoco. But Benjamin wrote in and thought it was Hunter Biden. And no, that was definitely not Hunter Biden. But I appreciated that somebody sent in a guess. And nobody guessed it, which is really tragic.
You've got a string of fooling people lately. So keep doing what you're doing.
Go me, go me. All right. So then this week, I don't know. I don't even know how to set this up, but it's short. So listen to it. I'll play it twice.
This is crack. Every time you use it, you risk dying.
Should I play that a second time, Larry? Ashley?
I don't know who it is either.
Okay.
I don't think playing it a second time will help, but I don't know who it is.
No.
Somebody said Nancy Reagan. No, not Nancy
Reagan. I was guessing
Tipper
Gore.
This is crack. Every time you use it, you risk dying.
Well, very good. Let's see. No new patrons. Any new subscribers, Larry?
No new subscribers.
Anything else you want to cover before? Let's see. Do you want to talk? We have a couple minutes. Did you want to talk about the guy that got the 7 years for the person that stormed into the Capitol? I don't think he made it into the Capitol. I don't think he's one of those people.
I'm not sure how much time we can spend on it, but I did intend to mention this is an example of what happens when you go to trial. He had an option, I'm sure the government always offers pleas, almost always, and he decided he was going to have his day in court, kind of like Sheriff Long. And he had his day in court, and he was sentenced the most harshly of any of the people who have their cases resolved thus far. And Ashley now practices in federal court on some limited level. And she can speak to what happens in terms of the federal sentencing structure. If you decide to go to trial, that is just not going to be a good situation. Ashley, what happens when you go to trial in federal court?
No, sentencing in federal court is based on federal guidelines, sentencing guidelines. There's a grid. And if you negotiate, they can usually mitigate it down. So you'll serve less time. But if you actually go to trial, you'll get whatever is maximum in that grid square, which apparently was 7 years in this case.
The person that we're speaking about is Guy Wesley Reffitt. I heard a podcast about this guy, his kid. Oh, my sound just went crap again, didn't it?
Yes, but his son did report him after overhearing conversations from his dad as that was about to unfold, and he became concerned about his father's stability, and he interpreted what his father was saying that something big was about to happen. So he turned them in through some app that allows you to report stuff to the FBI.
Yeah, he phoned in to the FBI, and so that was so that's the punishment for taking something to court.
So, all righty. Well, I'll stand in here for you since you're all messed up with your sound. So we appreciate all your support. And if you want to contact us, it's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Or you can leave an old-fashioned voicemail at 747-227-4477. And best of all, you can become a patron. And I forgot what that address is. It's patreon.com/registrymatters. And you can pick your level. I think you can select any level starting at $1. And you can go up to, we're looking for the 1400 month level. So if anybody can do that, we'd be greatly appreciative.
You've been listening to FYP.